I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region, a new show from KRCC. On today's show, we talk to Greg Lutzi, a Manitou Springs native who co-founded a digital photography company that aspires to be the Kodak of the 21st century.
Our goal is this big crazy dream to be the best creative company that's out there around. In the same way that Polaroid revolutionized things, in the same way Kodak revolutionized things.
Legendary poet and environmental activist Gary Snyder speaks with us about his long and storied career.
You know, I grew up in a working class environment during the Depression. I was aware of, you know, how alienating some poetry can be to neighbors and so forth.
And writer Mia Alvarado takes us on a field trip to Stoner's Laundry, a laundromat that's been a gathering place for a small neighborhood at the edge of downtown Colorado Springs for decades.
There's nothing to do at Stoner's Laundry. There are no TVs, no radios, no magazines. There's one soda machine and a rack for thrifty nickels that is usually empty.
All that today on The Big Something. You wouldn't know by looking at Greg Lutzi that he's the chief creative officer and co-founder of a tech company that recently capitalized to the tune of $40 million. Maybe that's because he doesn't live in Silicon Valley, where young executives in hoodies and tennis shoes are nothing out of the ordinary. Visual Supply Company, or VSCO, the digital photography company that he co-founded with Joel Flory in 2011, has been on a meteoric rise in the last few years. While they haven't shared specific user numbers for their products, evidence of their success can be found on the photo sharing site Instagram, where users frequently upload photos followed by hashtag VSCO or hashtag VSCOcam, indicating that the photos were edited using the VSCOcam smartphone app. As of the airing of this episode, hashtag VSCO and hashtag VSCOcam have combined been used almost 150 million times by people all over the world. The company, which also has its own photo sharing platform called VSCO Grid and a dedicated global user base, has offices in Oakland and New York. But, perhaps surprisingly, Greg Lutzi has chosen to settle with his family in his hometown of Manitou Springs, and he runs the creative side of the company out of an office in downtown Colorado Springs. I recently spoke with him here at the KRCC studios. You and Joel Flory started VSCO in 2011, and prior to that, you were working as a creative director for a graphic design firm in Seattle. And just talk a little bit about how the two of you met and how VSCO was born.
Sure. So I was art director, creative director. I was working out of a few different agencies in Seattle and then eventually out of Colorado Springs here. But initially in Seattle, I was working for a company called Asterisk Studio, and we did all bands, musicians, artwork, back when CDs were a little bit more important, you know, posters, t-shirts, websites. And one of the projects I worked on was for Jimmy Eat World, the band. And Joel was a really big fan. Joel was working as a wedding photographer in California, but he was also helping his dad rebrand his construction site. And so he contacted us because he liked the band. He found out who had done the website. We stayed in contact. We worked on Floyd Construction website brand, and we just always stayed in touch, which was kind of odd. I normally wouldn't have stayed in touch with people that I've worked with in that capacity, but we just kind of hit it off, and he was in California, I was in Seattle, but we always stayed in touch. And then a few years later, we collaborated, and I worked on his photography site and brand, and from that, we just started having discussions about everything from what's important to us in the creative industry or running a business or photography or just life in general. And we just started realizing, even though we're very different, we had a lot of similarities in vision and what we wanted to do. And so we decided to try it.
And so you started VSCO, and that was in 2011, right?
Correct, yeah.
And initially, what was it? What was the vision, and what were you guys hoping to accomplish?
Well, we knew for sure that we wanted to do something that was a by creatives for creatives kind of company. What it is now is the heart is still the same, but we've definitely grown in scope. We set out initially to do templated websites for photographers or designers built on WordPress. We realized that that wasn't quite what we wanted to do, and so we just started exploring, and we started with a team creating Viscofilm, which is essentially like presets that work with Adobe Photoshop and Lightroom as a way to essentially digitally archive film. We love actual classic film, but the reality is it's being cut. It's not, you know, the Kodaks and the Fujis of the world. It doesn't make sense for them to keep producing them because people aren't using them and it's very expensive. But we love the aesthetics and everything that's associated with it. So Viscofilm is essentially our way of digitally archiving that and saying the aesthetics that we've had before are still very important to us. We're just trying to take that into a way that's accessible to this new generation that everything is digital. But people sometimes are like, well, why do you guys don't like film? It's actually the opposite. We love film. But we also realize that where things are going, we need to stay up with that and how people are using technology.
And so the idea was you would create a product that would allow people to take photographs that still had the quality of film and that sort of vintage appeal, but were also digital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, by and large, people are shooting digitally these days. And so what we're trying to do is very accurately and scientifically recreate these different film stocks. That is very much more inclined towards a professional product. And so from there, we launched something that was a little more accessible to everybody, and that's the phone. People are just shooting on the phone today. And so that's where we launched ViscoCam, and that's on Android or iOS. Anyone can download it, and it's free. And then it comes with these presets on it, and then they can purchase more if they want and different tools. So in some ways, it's a little bit of a digital darkroom, but we've tried to make it very accessible for people.
And so if I'm understanding right, you started out as a company that was mostly catering toward people who might be film and photography geeks a little bit and who really had a specific thing that they were looking for. But as time went on, you saw that there was maybe a larger demand for that kind of a product than you had initially thought. Is that accurate?
Well, I think it is accurate to say we did start very professional product-based for the professional market. And I don't think we're ever going to leave that. That's something very near and dear to us. But at the same time, we want anyone anywhere to be able to discover what it means to take a photo. And that spark of creativity is an amazing thing. And we want to be part of that wherever people are on their creative journey. If it's someone who the first time is finding out about photography, we want to be able to be there to inspire them and to give them these tools to equip them. But then we also want to, we are by creatives for creatives company, so the people that this is what they do as their biggest passion, or this is what they do because this is their job and they love that, we want to be able to make tools and support them in that way if possible. Essentially, what it comes down to is we love photography, we love creating, we love the ability for people to express and show what they're doing. And wherever they are on that journey, we want to be able to equip them with that.
I came to find out about VSCO in a way that I think a lot of people probably have, which is on Instagram, the popular photo sharing app. And there's a hashtag on there, VSCO Cam. And I started to notice it maybe about 6 months ago, where I would see these really striking images that people I follow on Instagram had posted. And, you know, they'd be very well composed. And, you know, it's the people who I follow who seem to be most into photography as an art form would post VSCO Cam. And, you know, as of today, I was just looking at that hashtag. There are, I think, over 80 million posts on Instagram with that tag. So obviously, VSCO has caught on in some way and has really caught fire in the sort of social media landscape. When did that start to happen? Like, when did you guys start to realize that, oh, wow, this is actually taking root in a way we didn't maybe expect?
Sure. I think when we launched the app, at the time, there was a lot of photography apps out already, but none that really treated the post-processing as you can be minimal and it can be okay. A lot of them at the time were lots of textures and lots of colors to the point that it didn't look real. And for us, we wanted to be rooted in that realness and rooted in essentially the aesthetic of classic film. And so when we did launch ViscoCam, there was a lot of people that really gravitated towards that, I think, were excited because it wasn't a gimmick. Most photography apps at the time, they weren't bad, but they definitely didn't hold that same desire to be like, this, I can take quote-unquote real photographs with this. So I think a lot of people gravitated towards that. We've been really fortunate to have a strong creative community all over the world that have really embraced it. And I think, you know, we speculate exactly why someone would continue to want to hashtag that. And I think a lot of it comes down to they realize they're part of something that's going on, something bigger worldwide. So they're proud to be part of it. Also, you know, we've heard from a lot of people when they put that hashtag to them, it's a stamp of quality saying I actually care about photography. And so we've been fortunate, but we're very grateful for that community that's evolved around that.
And so are there even people who will hashtag a photo on Instagram, VSCO cam or hashtag VSCO, that maybe didn't even take that photograph using the VSCO
app? I'm guessing that happens a lot, yeah.
Which is interesting. I mean, it means that people associate your product with something more than just the product itself.
Yeah, I think, and this is me speculating, but I think particularly on social media, the likes and comments is such a powerful thing, important thing to people. And so by hashtagging us, knowing people are searching for that, looking for quality photographs, they'll add that. We kind of have a slightly different view on that. We have our own platform called VSCOGrid, which is just an opportunity. There's no likes or no comments. It's ability for people to just show what they find inherently beautiful, because the likes and comments, that's fun, and that is what it is. We're not going to knock that. But for what we're trying to do, we want people to be honest about what they're seeing and what's important to them. To us, that's more in line with a true artist or true creative to create something that they inherently find beautiful, interesting, raw, dangerous, etc., and to show that without worrying about, man, am I going to get a lot of likes or comments on this? So in answer to your question, yes, I do think people do that. It is what it is.
And so with this app, the VSCO Grid, it sounds like what you're kind of trying to do is cut through the noise of social media. And I think that that's something that a lot of people can probably relate to in some way. If you spend a lot of time on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram or on any number of different social media platforms, I think it can become kind of exasperating in a way to constantly be seeking that feedback or that recognition for something that you've posted. Is that part of what you were reacting to in creating the VSCO Grid?
Yeah, absolutely. I think social media is good for what it is. It's brought a lot, there's a lot of value with it. We wouldn't be a company without it. We didn't have the money when we started to do traditional television or print advertising. And so social media is a great way to be able to communicate with a lot of people all over the world. And so it's not a bad thing. I think where we react towards it is we see so many people that become so ingrained in the idea that my worth is built on if I have likes or comments or the people that follow me. Whereas for us, we want people to be able to feel free to express themselves as they really see. And so we see people that if they have, say, an Instagram account and a Grid account, they post very different things. And that's okay. That's fine. We encourage people to use both of the platforms. For us, we want to be a creative platform. We want to be a photography platform, not a communications platform. And so, you know, if you look at Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, they are great communication platforms. For us, we are completely fine saying we are a platform that is all about honoring art and artists, and that's our main goal. And so we approach Grid much like we would a gallery. So a gallery, you're thoughtful about what you put in an exhibition. It's curated. There's limited wall space, so you're not going to put, say, 500 pieces of art on the wall. You'll choose 12, 15, whatever space that you have. And so we encourage people to be thinking more in that regards of think about what you're shooting, think about what you're showing, think about what's important to you. And the reason that we don't have comments and likes is we would find it odd to go into a gallery and, you know, be writing comments on a wall. And so we want to make the image be what is king, what is important, and the expression of that person, rather than do a lot of other people like it. you know, determine it for what it is, not for what people have said it is based on stars.
Mm-hmm. Just looking through the VSCO app, there's not a lot of writing in it. It's got a very minimal kind of feel to it. And in a way, looking through it, it feels almost quiet for that reason. You know, it's just images and icons that don't have explanations necessarily about what they are, what they do. You just kind of have to explore to figure it out. Was that something that you were also going for, to kind of recreate the quiet sort of reflective atmosphere of an art gallery, like you said?
To some degree. I think also Wayne Wu, who's our chief experience officer, he's our lead design, has a thing that he says of respect humanity, meaning we believe people are smart and people can figure things out. Most of the times when you see an app, they're made as simple as possible. But for us, we assume that someone with a little bit of time and exploration can find it. And so you're right, not everything is labeled. In some ways, I think some people are not going to ever like that, and that's okay. In other ways, if you explore something instead of being told how to do things, you have a greater capacity to learn. So I have a 4-year-old daughter, and I could give her a paint by numbers, and she could probably produce a paint by numbers unicorn, and it could look pretty good. Or I could give her a blank piece of paper and paintbrushes, and she'll create kind of a blob right now. And it won't look that great. I'll be proud of it as a dad, but it won't look amazing. But over time, if we can teach her, hey, this is how you draw or explore or try this, or what happens when you mix colors, as opposed to saying, yeah, just click, just a 1, 2, 3, just follow that line, there's a greater capacity in the long run to produce something amazing. And so we approach it a little bit like that. Also, additionally, we're 83% international is our community of users. And so by going more icon-based, it enables people that wouldn't be able to read English or some other language, and they can explore and figure it out fast. And so a lot of people are actually really, really get into the idea of, oh, that's great, that I don't have to be reading long instructions. I can just play and explore and figure things out.
And also communicate with other people around the world who you might not share a language with, just simply through images and
sure.
through photographs.
Sure, yeah.
And was that part of your intention when you set out to create this company, was to create something that was international? Or was it just that as time went on, it kind of caught on and it grew in the way that things do in the internet age? And
yeah.
And
well, a little bit of both. For us, we have our own online journal, which is just creatives and photographers that we find interesting from all over the world. And so in some ways, we're very intentional, meaning we went out and found people that were using VSCO or just creating great products from all over the world, and we highlighted them. And so that there was definitely some intention about that, because I think it can be easy to get really insulated here in the U.S. of like, man, we're all that's going on. And it's like, no, not really. There's some amazing things going on in Malaysia or Saudi Arabia or China. And so we really celebrate that. To be honest, though, I mean, we get that question a lot. How in the world did you get that? Because for a lot of app companies, that's a huge thing to be international. And to some degree, I don't think we necessarily know, other than photography is something that is very universal. And I think people really resonate with that and the ability to see into someone's day-to-day life of, this is what life looks like on the streets here, you know, in Jakarta, or this is what life looks like inside of a home in Pittsburgh or wherever that is. I think there's something very interesting about that.
You started this company in 2011. It's 2015 now, and you have millions of users, I assume, around the world, and the hashtag has become this viral phenomenon. What's that been like for you personally to be in the midst of that and to see this company go from a tiny startup to something that has really caught on and is a serious company?
To be honest, it's been a big honor. I think we always had big dreams and big visions, but you never know how that's really going to pan out and how that's really going to look. Right now, we're still at very much a beginning point. Our goal is this big crazy dream to be the best creative company that's out there around. In the same way that Polaroid revolutionized things, the same way Kodak revolutionized things. And granted, they've run into struggles now, but in that same way, we want to be that to this new generation that suddenly had access to the ability to take a photo, where before a lot of people, you had to either have a lot of money or you'd have to be really committed to photography. And so now it's exciting to be part of something where so many people have access to that. Did we think it would be where it is now? I mean, we currently have 135 employees. Probably not, you know? But at the same time, we feel like we're playing for something that's really important and a lot bigger. That doesn't always involve just money, you know? Obviously, we need to run a smart business. We need to be efficient for that, but that is not the passion and not the heart, and it hasn't been. We want to do something that helps creatives and changes people's perspectives on what it means to create and what it means to make.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was my interview with Greg Lutze, Chief Creative Officer and co-founder of Visual Supply Company, or VSCO, maker of the hugely popular digital photography app, VSCO Cam. Lutze is a native of Manitou Springs, where he currently lives with his family, and he runs the creative side of the company out of an office in downtown Colorado Springs. To hear that interview again, and for more info, head to krcc.org. I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something. We'll be right back. This is The Big Something. I'm Jake Brownell. Poet and essayist Gary Snyder is something of a living legend. He first rose to prominence in San Francisco in the 1950s as a central figure in the Beat Movement and San Francisco poetry renaissance. He read his poem A Berry Feast at the reading at which Allen Ginsberg debuted the poem Howl, and he was the inspiration for the character Jaffe Ryder in Jack Kerouac's 1958 novel The Dharma Bums. In the more than half century since he broke onto the national stage, he's written many books and has had a profound influence on American culture, not just as a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, but also as an environmental activist, translator of Chinese and Japanese literature, and serious practitioner and proponent of Zen Buddhism. And at 84 years old, he's still writing, with a new collection of poems, This Present Moment, out this month. He was in Colorado Springs to speak at Colorado College for Earth Day. I interviewed him in advance of that talk. Most people will know you first and foremost as a poet, but you've done many things in your career. You've written essays, you're a scholar, you've done a lot of translation, and you're known for your Buddhism as well. And I wonder at this point in your career, how do you think of yourself? Do you think of yourself first and foremost as a poet?
Yeah, with my own, you know, provisos on how people think of poetry and what they think it is about. And I also have to point out that almost 50% of my writing is in prose. And that I've got a number of prose books out, some of which are quite active in the world and have had considerable influence in the environmental movement, and which I value very much. And I find that it is as challenging to me to be writing good prose as it is to be writing poetry, but it is a different kind of exercise.
And so when did you start writing in your life?
Well, all of us started scribbling when we were about in first grade, right? That's writing. You know, making graphic representations of spoken sounds. And language is all, of course, auditory, spoken sound. You know, like most people, I was taken by the possibility of the intense little lyric phraseology that children come up with, like baby, baby, suck your toe all the way to Mexico, or kindergarten baby, wash your face with gravy. That kind of wordplay, children fall into it right away, and they love it. So I took a lot of pleasure in that when I was little, and also storytelling. So I just slipped into writing poems when I was around 15 or 16 out of, and this is where poetry comes from, intense emotional experiences of one sort or another. And most teenagers and most poets in the world, it seems, or many of them anyway, start out by writing poems about their sadness and also about their ecstasy in teenage love.
And that would go for you as well in your early poems?
Well, it's oddly enough, it was not true for me. I started writing poetry about mountaineering. That's what drove me into it. I started doing snow peak mountaineering in the Pacific Northwest when I was 15, and I couldn't get enough of it. Getting up very, very early in the morning and being up on the ice and snow when the daylight first comes, and risking yourself sometimes, and all kinds of weird things happening. You never know what to expect. So I loved that, and I wrote some early poems about that. I found out about girls just a little bit later. But then I discovered the poetry that was in books and the poetry that was taught in classes. And, you know, that gave me another perspective, and so I moved on into being more literate and more literary in my writing in my late teens, and also started listening on Folkways records of the blues and the Appalachian folk songs, and I was playing the guitar and singing, and I learned to sing lots and lots of songs, and that was a big help too.
Part of what your poetry has come to be known for is you seem to be comfortable in the vernacular in terms of kind of speaking simply and writing in terms and using words that would be familiar to kind of the average American. And was that something that you gravitated to early on in terms of the types of poetry and the types of music that you like to listen to and read?
Well, I certainly, you know, I grew up in a working class environment during the Depression up in the Pacific Northwest. And I helped the family farm out by delivering milk from our cows in glass bottles on bicycles. So I certainly knew a lot of people, and I was aware of, you know, how alienating some poetry can be to neighbors and so forth. But in the long term, you know, the poem dictates to you what the language is going to be. And so I have written poems in which I'm happy to say the language is very clear, and most people can understand. And I've written other poems that are rather opaque and require more learning. And I mix them up sometimes. You know, like the word frass, F-R-A-S-S, is in one of my recent poems. And it's a poem about splitting firewood. And I find that it's a nice thing to do to tell the audience what frass means.
I'm not familiar with the word frass.
Nobody is. Foresters and woodcutters. It's the brown sawdust powder that is pushed out through the bark of trees by the pine bark beetles that are eating away inside. And it's a sign that your tree has been attacked by pine bark beetles. And once you've got frass on the surface of your pine tree, on the bark, why, you can forget it. The tree's going to die.
Well, if not familiar with that word, I think people in this region will be familiar with that phenomenon, at least.
Yeah, so, you know, they've got something to connect it to.
In the early 50s, you moved down to San Francisco and became associated in various ways with the Beat Generation and with the San Francisco poetry renaissance. And there's a quote of yours from an essay that you wrote in 1960 that I just wanted to read that I thought was interesting. And you're kind of talking about that time. And you say, what we had discovered or rediscovered was that the imagination has a free and spontaneous life of its own, that it can be trusted, that what flows from a spontaneous mind is poetry, and that this is more basic and more revolutionary than any political program based on, quote, civilized abstractions that end up murdering human beings in the name of historical necessity or reason or liberty. I think, you know, in that time and in that place, obviously it was a highly politicized environment in certain ways. And I wonder how, as a young man, you thought about the connection between art and poetry and politics.
Well, everybody that was working in the arts in those days saw the political connections. I would say almost everybody anyway. Certainly the circles I moved with up and down the West Coast, and also my friends from New York, as I gradually met more and more of them, because they turned up on the West Coast, you know. Like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac just turned up. I don't think it's a new discovery. It's in no ways a new discovery, if you look at history, that art and imagination are in the forefront of questioning what the assumed virtue of the official establishment line is. And it is still in the forefront of that. It doesn't have as much effect sometimes as we might want it to have.
When you first began writing and when you were moving in these circles and kind of thinking about art and what it means to be a poet, and also being concerned with issues of politics and morality and, you know, some of the radical politics of the time, did you struggle at all with kind of wondering how to incorporate those kinds of values and ideas into your work as a poet and to make it still poetry, to make it art rather than something else?
Well, it's what I did. I did exactly what you just said. Did I struggle to? So no, I didn't struggle to do it. I just did it.
You didn't think too much about it. You just kind of did it.
I knew what was necessary, and my academic and scholarly studies and research nailed it all home to me. I was working in anthropology. I went back to 30,000 or 40,000 years ago, to start judging what human beings had been up to. I took a really good look at Native American cultures and how they worked and survived. And then I became interested not only in ancient Mediterranean cultures, but in China and Japan and East Asia. And I saw what was lacking, you know, in the modern world, which is a whole lot. And so I pulled that into my prose writing and wrote essays exploring that, and as accurately as I could. And at the same time, I wrote the poems that were generated by the feelings and insights that went with it.
And for you, what's the distinction between the kind of ideas that make sense for a poem versus the kind of ideas that inspire a prose essay?
That is the critical question for people who are serious writers. And it has to do with the nature of metaphor, the nature of imagery, the choice of language, and the play of the imagination. And so I quote sometimes to make the point, an 18th century haiku poet whose name was Busan, who said, "It is extremely important to remain unprepared for yourself to write poetry." And that is exactly right. You do not write poetry from deliberate intentions. You write poetry when it comes to you. You can flog yourself to write prose, and you have to sometimes, but a poetry you can't flog yourself to. Either you do it or you don't do it. And, you know, somebody writes you or calls you and says, "Write me an anti-Vietnam War poem." You know, and you say, "Well, I'm waiting for it, but don't count on it till I get it." And so that's always true.
I think your style as a poet, at least at first, it seems very observational. There's a lot of very concrete imagery of things that you seem to be witnessing and in a way kind of bearing witness to, whether it's in the natural world or in human culture or looking at ancient myth or older traditions. So is that for you as a poet, is that part of that being unprepared in terms of just allowing yourself to observe in some way?
Well, that's, that's a kindergarten step is what that is. But you can't even be a bird watcher without having adequate and accurate observations. But learning to be an observer, which translates into, on a slightly larger scale, something that has become very popular in the United States recently, and I completely welcome it, which is the whole idea of the practice of mindfulness. You know, the term mindfulness is a very meaningful term. It means thinking clearly and observing correctly, both. And it means keeping calm. And it means knowing who you are and what your steps are. And so I certainly welcome that. And it is, of course, inspired by Buddhism.
When you first got interested in Buddhism, it was by no means as ubiquitous in American popular culture as it is today. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how you came to Buddhism and why you decided to study it with the kind of rigor that you did.
Well, I came to Buddhism quite simply for ethical reasons, because I discovered that unlike the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, or a bunch of other people, they valued the non-human world of life and are quite clear about that. When they say not to take life, they mean to try not to take any kind of life. It's not that you don't sometimes, it's not that you don't even have to sometimes, but be aware of what you're doing. That is not in the Ten Commandments. And so I started following Buddhist ideas when I was still living on the dairy farm. You know, lamenting the loss of a heifer that had died of some ailment, a heifer that I'd been raising. And then in the Sunday school, asking would the heifer go to heaven and being told, no, heifers don't go to heaven, neither do the cats. And I said, well, heck, I'm out of here, and I left. But then I discovered, you know, in the literature, both the Chinese and Japanese poetry on the one side, and the sophisticated philosophical texts that were generated by Buddhism in a number of languages, that this is a really marvelous and very intelligent way of trying to understand the world. And understand yourself in the world.
And in your poetry, it seems like, you know, one of the things that you return to a lot is observation of the natural world happening, you know, the ways in which animals relate to plants and relate to each other apart from human interference, but also considering human interference.
Yeah, you're right. But, you know, you're overlooking, and a lot of people do overlook, poems that I write that are quite urban, like Walking the New York Bedrock poem. Mm-hmm. And I distance myself from being called a nature poet. The real world is the real thing, and it's not all nature.
There's a poem that I like from your book, Turtle Island, that, you know, I don't know if you have any of your poems at hand nearby, if you could read this or not, or if I should just read it.
You're going to, because I'm standing under some trees out in the meadow.
All right, well, I'll be happy to read it. It's called It Pleases.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It pleases. Far above the dome of the Capitol, it's true, a large bird soars against white cloud, wings arced, sailing easy in this humid southern sun-blurred breeze. The dark-suited policeman watches tourist cars. And the center of power is nothing. Nothing here. Old white stone domes, strangely quiet people, earth-sky bird patterns, idly interlacing. The world does what it pleases. Washington, D.C., 1973.
Yeah.
That poem, you know, in a way, I think it gets at what you're saying in that it's a nature poem in a way. It's talking about the birds, it's talking about the weather, it's talking about the sun-blurred breeze, but it's also talking about human culture and power as being part of that nature in a way, and also as being kind of ignorant of that nature. It's making a lot of different points through some very subtle observations, I think. That seems kind of emblematic of your style.
Well, you know, that's a very good insight. You know, you picked a very interesting poem, and your analysis of it is quite right. I mean, can't add much to that except say that I've written whole essays about that topic with more complexity, but the point does it very nicely. And I wrote a book called The Practice of the Wild, prose book, in which I tried to explore and further define what the meaning of the word wild is, because wild is a process, actually. It's the process of the universe going about its business, temporarily without the agency of human beings. And that's what the world is, and that's what we are. You know, if you are, if you take a Darwinian type evolution as being halfway true, then human beings are a product of the wild process, just like everything else. And it's fascinating to look at that, because we don't have to even know how it works in a way. But it is what science enjoys trying to figure out a little bit.
I was interested in something that the poet Michael McClure said about your work, which is he described what you do as in the tradition of wisdom literature, which to me means in the tradition of, say, Lao Tzu and even maybe Rumi, the Sufi mystic poet, or concerned with these kind of spiritual questions on some level and writing for revelation in some way. Is that something that you identify with? Is that a characterization that you identify with?
I try not to be obvious.
What do you mean by that?
I wouldn't write like Rumi. Lao Tzu is probably a kind of poet, that text, but I wouldn't, you know, try to write like that either. One can only write the kind of poetry that you write yourself. And you can't even dictate what it's supposed to be like or how it's going to come out. And, you know, so my latest book of poems, which is just out right now, called The This Present Moment, it's really different than what I've written before. A lot of it is. One doesn't want to repeat oneself too many times. Or as Peter Coyote says, don't buy your own poster.
That's a good line.
It's a great line.
Gary Snyder, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
That was my conversation with poet and essayist Gary Snyder, who is in town to speak at Colorado College on Earth Day. To hear that interview again, or for more information, head to krcc.org. I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something. We'll be right back. This is The Big Something. I'm Jake Brownell. Colorado Springs poet, novelist, and essayist Mia Alvarado has an eye and an ear for the particulars and peculiarities of place. In this essay, she takes us to Stoner's Laundry, one of the last laundromats in downtown Colorado Springs since the recent closure of Couture's.
Stoner's Coin-Op Laundry is on the corner of Wasatch Avenue and St. Vrain Street in downtown Colorado Springs. The white stucco building was built in 1904 and was, until 1958, the ideal grocery and market. City directories note that it was vacant the following year. In 1960, it appears as Roy C. and Mrs. Betty Mason's Econo-Wash self-serve, on a line next to entries that indicate that this woman is the widow of Charles William and that this man is a lineman for the telephone company. The 1975 directory has it under the surname Stoner. Some patrons swear it is a laundromat for stoners, and a banner of cannabis graffiti is still legible under layers of mismatched white paint. ''75 was a prosperous year for the Stoner family. They had four Speed Queen laundries and a trophy room and taxidermy shop. Those are gone now, but their original laundromat is still in business, though the word original has almost faded from the hand-lettered sign. It is open every day from 7 a.m. until 9 p.m. In the daytime, the building's southern face is a gallery for an ongoing installation called Shadows of Branches. In the evening, its western windows are a tableau by Hopper in a scene made for Christenberry. At night, Stoner's looks like a lantern. For 5 years, we lived three houses down from Stoner's and across the street from Lloyd, his sister Wanda, and her husband Dave. Dave drives a decrepit minivan around town, the back window of which declares, "If you're passing me, you're speeding." When we'd get to our street, my three-year-old daughter would say, "There's Stoner's Laundry," to indicate that she was home. There is nothing to do at Stoner's Laundry. There are no TVs, no radios, no magazines. There is one soda machine and a rack for thrifty nickels that is usually empty. I've seen few so-called smartphones in the place. You can sit in a plastic chair or you can sit in a metal chair. People talk and some hold court for hours. They fold clothes. They head outside to smoke. At some point, someone crawled under one of the three folding tables and drew intricate, skillful studies of a pine cone, a bird, and a tree by water. This woman drives over on Sunday nights in an Econo van with other people from her storefront downtown church. Her Bible has Jesus' words in red. Some people come because Stoner's has the hottest dryers in town. Others only like to come in the morning when it's quiet. Often there are one or two homeless men at Stoner's, especially when it's cold. The man in the orange hat brings a radio with him and stands before it, talking. The man in the red coat had a bad stepfather in Michigan. He's still trying to escape. I always ask people if I can take their photo. He said yes, but first he wanted to straighten his clothes. One recently homeless man wrote a book of poems called "I Lost My Pants." He travels with his two remaining possessions, a black plastic bag full of clothes and his notebook. Over the poems, he's written down the addresses of possible homes. Stoner's feels like a public place. In the hours between when the doors are unlocked and locked again, it is an experiment in small-scale anarchy and communal property that works. The owner isn't around, and neither are the cops. People sleep here. They kiss. They charge their phones and wash up. It is not unusual for the neighbors to bring food to strangers who say they have nothing to eat. Children seem to like it here. There are poles and baskets and things to climb on and floors to slide down and interesting spinning machines. The mothers and fathers aren't up to much, and sometimes someone brings Funyuns or a ball. This block was built up by black people with tuberculosis who moved to Colorado Springs for the sanatoriums and the balm of high, dry air. Now the air smells like clean laundry. Most of the year, the doors of Stoner's are propped open, and the sky and the people stream in and out.
That was poet, essayist, and novelist Mia Alvarado. Her most recent book of poems, Hey Folly, is available from Dos Madres Press. The Big Something is produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC, with help from Emily Frogen and Amelia Whitmer. You can listen again to this episode and learn more about today's guest at krcc.org. The Big Something is part of KRCC Presents, a new weekly showcase of locally produced content right here on Radio Colorado College. Tune in for original, local programming every Friday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. on 91.5 KRCC.